What I thought we're doing for the last two sessions is look more at the practical side of things, and maybe the theory has been a little bit theoretical so far, and it's difficult to, I think, avoid that completely when you're looking at dependent arising, and it's always going to be a little bit theoretical perhaps, but the point is, of course, that in the end, what it shows us where the problem really lies. The problem lies with avidya, with this delusion, and then we know that what that is, what we have to rectify. And as soon as we have kind of, as soon as we are clear about where the problem lies, it becomes also very clear, essentially, what we have to do to get out of that problem. That is what I want to have a look at this morning. And there's two ways in particular that the Buddha describes the way out of the problem. And one way is to look at the process of what happens, subjectively speaking, when we do the practice. It's the subjective, the experiential, personal way of experiencing the path, so to speak. And the other way is more how we apply ourselves, right? It's one of the great things I was saying before about the Buddha's teachings. He gives he looks at things from different angles, different views, the same process, but from different angles. And because he does that, he gives you a very broad understanding of what is happening, which is great. So, to overcome avidya, there is this process, and this process, the way it is felt subjectively and experientially, it is sometimes called the psychology of meditation, is what some people would call it. So how should the process of meditation ideally unfold as a subjective personal experience? Right? How should it ideally unfold? And this is what this is about. It's not just about meditation, it's actually about the whole path, right? How does your mind evolve in a sense over time as you're practicing this path, is what this is about. And this is sometimes called transcendental dependent origination, or as dependent liberation, depending on how you want to use the terminology. And it takes us through the steps that lead to the destruction or the ending of avidya and to the giving rise to vidya, in other words, the opposite of delusion. So this I'm going to read out the sutta this time, and then I'm going to explain to you what is going on. So this is this particular sutta is called Volition from the Anguttara 11, and this is how it goes. I'll just read it out to you. It's very repetitive and very boring in some ways, but this is often how the suttas are, right? Sometimes they can look really boring unless you really get into it and understand all the implications of what are going on there. So this is how it goes. Because for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be exerted, let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in one who is virtuous, one whose behavior is virtuous. For one without regret, no volition, no will need be exerted, let joy arise in me. It is natural that joy arises in one without regret. For one who is joyful, no volition need be exerted, let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. For one with a rapturous mind, no volition need be exerted, let my body become tranquil. It is natural that the body of one with a rapturous mind is tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no volition need be exerted. Let me feel pleasure. It is natural that one tranquil in body feels pleasure. For one feeling pleasure, no volition need be exerted. Let my mind be stilled. It is natural that the mind of one feeling pleasure is stilled. For one who is stilled, no volition need be exerted. Let me know and see things according to reality. It is natural that one who is stilled knows and sees things according to reality. For one who knows and sees things according to reality, no volition need be exerted. Let me be repelled. It's enchanted. It is natural that one who sees things according to reality is repelled. For one who is repelled, no volition need be exerted, and let me become dispassionate. It is natural that one who is repelled becomes dispassionate. For one who is dispassionate, no volition need be exerted, let me realize the knowledge and vision of liberation. It is natural that one who is dispassionate realizes the knowledge and vision of liberation. And of course, liberation is precisely the ending of ignorance, right? The ending of delusion and liberation are the same thing. So once you get to that point, the last point, that means that you have overturned avijja, which is at the base of dependent arising. And because you have overturned what is at the base of dependent arising, you know that the whole thing starts to unfold. With the cessation of avijja, of delusion, comes the sensation of the will, the sankharas, right, which are the, what they have transferred on that before, the kind of the creative activity, the creative effort in us. And with that, the whole thing unfolds, the whole thing ceases, until suffering itself ceases at the very end. This is how it comes about, right? This is kind of exciting, isn't it? This is the path, this is the way, this is how we feel, how you experience this particular thing. And what, maybe, I'm not sure where to start, but maybe, one other thing that I always find so fascinating about this is the incredible emphasis in this particular sutta on happiness, right? Various types of happiness. This is the path to liberation. And you see, you go through that, and everything almost, in one way or another, revolves around this idea of some sort of happiness, pleasure, right? Fun, having a good time, enjoying yourself, being at ease, right? And this is, you know, so this is the Buddha's emphasis on what meditation is all about. Starting off with non-regret, right, moving all the way down to samadhi, which are translated as stillness, rather than concentration, because concentration lends itself to misunderstanding. All of that are incredibly pleasurable states all the way through them. And then, of course, you come towards the end, which is where you have the profound insights, seeing things according to reality, this thing he calls this disenchantment here, which I think should be translated more like being repelled, actually, to be honest. It's a much stronger word. But all of these things are very positive experiences as well. You may think that being repelled doesn't sound so good, but actually being repelled is good. It's good. It feels good when you're repelled. This is a real thing. This is a, what is it? There's a saying apparently somewhere in Thailand, a famous Thai monk called Ajahn Buddhadasa, who he died about a couple of decades ago. And he had this big statue or this big monument in his monastery, and there was an inscription in this monument that says, "Happiness at last, you know that there's no happiness in the world." Right? It's interesting, isn't it? But what it means is that when you understand suffering, when you see things with insight, even though you understand everything is suffering, actually, that is a great happiness. It's like a relief. You can let go of everything, and you find peace, and you find something much more profound as a consequence. So it's weird, right? This is so counterintuitive often. This is what makes it so both interesting and also a bit unsettling sometimes. But what is very not unsettling, what is very settling, if you like, the opposite of unsettling, what is very settling here is the fact that happiness is so important aspect of this path of Buddhism. Everything, right? Meditation, but everything else as well has to do with happiness in one way or another. I'm going to look at what is called the gradual training, maybe in our second session later on today. And there too, part of the gradual training, you will see again, at every step of the way, happiness comes in, right? You are virtuous. From virtue comes the feeling, what is called the anavajja sukha, the happiness of being blameless. Right, just being blameless, it's good, right? Nobody can blame you. And then you keep on going from that, stage by stage, feeling more and more happy. So this to me is the one of the very important takeaway messages of the sutta, the idea that happiness is so central in the Buddhist teachings. And this is a very powerful guide, right? If you are meditating, you're sitting down, are you actually enjoying it in a certain sense? Are you feeling more at ease? Are you actually moving in this direction that this sutta is pointing to? Right? So it's a very helpful guide. In your whole life it's a very helpful guide. Is it actually heading in that direction or is it not? It becomes like an overarching theme for your entire practice, you know? Is it actually leading in the right direction? And it's important to be aware of that, because as I said on the first day, it is very easy to think that suffering, you know, torturing the body, that is what leads to happiness, right? We're going to free our spirit by making sure this evil body is kind of, you know, is sorted out, right? But it doesn't work like that, which is very fascinating. You have to have compassion for yourself, compassion for the body, compassion for everything. And whatever defilements are there, you have to accept those with kindness and with sympathy towards yourself and everyone else. So this is the first thing, but of course, also important here is, and this is another thing I mentioned, I think, on the first day, for those of you who may not know the suttas and the Buddha's teachings all that well, the question is, how reliable is this sutta, right? How, is this a common theme in the sutta? Is this something the Buddha talks about a lot? Or is it like, have I kind of cherry-picked one sutta which kind of supports my view, right? This is what often happens. I have this view. So you cherry pick a few passages which I think is kind of weird, right? You can interpret it in different ways. You take those out and then you use that to kind of make a particular point. Sometimes that happens. And this is why it is so good to read the suttas for yourself. Because when you read it for yourself, you can kind of go beyond what I say, right? Or what anybody else says. And you get a feeling yourself whether what is being said is true or not. Because it is very unreliable. And even if I try my very best to tell you, you know, what I think is the word of the Buddha, sometimes I'm just stupid, right? I'm deluded. I'm not claiming to be an arahant or anything like that. So because of my own delusion, you can't trust me 100%. I can't trust myself 100%. So how can you trust me 100%, right? You can't. So because of that, read these things for yourself and then find out. I believe I'm teaching the real thing, but I could just be mistaken about that. That's how you should think. That's how I should think. Again, the way that I regard this, and the way I decide what are core teachings of the Buddha, again, is if the Buddha says these things again and again and again, whether these are spoken to many different people, in many different contexts, in many different places. And when you know that is the case, it must be a core teaching of the Buddha. And this is one of these teachings that you find again and again in the suttas, right? In different shapes and different forms, sometimes with fewer factors, sometimes with more factors, but it's a very core kind of teaching. And one of the interesting things, for those of you who are a little bit interested also perhaps in the historical things, matters behind this, of course, one of the problems with just having the Pali text is that sometimes the Pali text could have been corrupted, right? How do you know that the Pali text is right? It's been around for 2,500 years. Surely it has been corrupted over 2,500 years. Nothing lasts for 2,500 years, right? The only exception is it's like some aspects of India where you go and things are exactly the same after 2,500 years. But discounting India and some other weird things like that, surely it is impossible that these texts could have been kept intact 2,500 years. Right? It doesn't make any sense, right? It's just human mind is so fallible. We know that it was memorized by heart in the early days, transmitted orally from one generation to another generation. How can that be sufficient to keep these things exactly the same? And then it was transmitted by writing down, even in writing, people often make mistakes. Right? And they make writing mistakes, they get the wrong word because people are by nature flawed, right? So they mistakes always creep in. And this is why this is so astonishing, because historically speaking, I was you may be aware that early in the Buddha's history, Buddhism divided up into a large number of different schools, right? Theravada, or the school that went to Sri Lanka, was only one. You could call it the Pali school, if you like. And you had other schools called Sarvastivada, you had the Mahasanghika, you had the Dhammaguptaka schools. And there's kind of the standard number of 18 early schools, which is a bit misleading, but that doesn't really matter for now. And the point is that this separation into schools happened largely around the time of Ashoka. And Ashoka, he lived roughly 2,300 years ago, right? So what happens, what is interesting here, if you are able to get hold of suttas, right, from one of these other schools that split off from the Pali school, split off from what is now called the Theravada at the time of Ashoka, and then you can compare it. That will be exciting, right? Because if they had been apart for 2,300 300 years, and you compare them, and you find that they are still pretty much the same. It means that the Sangha has been able, it's basically the Sangha's duty to keep these things going. The Sangha has been able to preserve these things intact, basically for the whole period of the time of the Buddha himself. And of course, lo and behold, that is exactly what you find. Because the suttas, they don't just exist in Pali, they exist also in other languages. In particular, they exist in Chinese. And they were translated into Chinese starting from around the year zero in the Christian era, or now called the Common Era. And starting from then, the main bulk of suttas were translated about the 4th century AD. And these stem from the Sarvastivada school. And the Sarvastivada school split off from the Theravada about around the time of Ashoka. And these days you can actually get some of these suttas that are being translated now from the Chinese into English. And on a recent retreat I did in Singapore, I think it was, I read out the Chinese version, right, and compared the Chinese translation into English and compared it to the Pali. So I read out both side by side. And this was exactly the sutta I read out, this particular sutta. And when you read it side by side, you wouldn't be able to tell which one is which, right? That's how similar they are. They're almost word for word, almost syllable for syllable, exactly the same. It's astonishing. And then, you know, your natural instinct, surely after 2,500 years, these things have degenerated. But then you put them side by side and you see that they actually have been kept intact, more or less exactly word for word after such a long period of time. This is not always true. This particular sutta is very repetitive, right? The first thing you think when you read a sutta is, oh, boring, right? It's so repetitive. I can't keep my attention focused on this. This is what some people always say. And there's some truth to that, of course. But because it is so repetitive and so boring, it actually makes it easier to keep it intact. Because the pattern is there. All you have to do is remember the structure in that pattern. When you remember that structure, you will keep it intact, especially as far as memory and oral transmission is concerned. It's very important to have easy structures to memorize them. So this is what is happening as you. So with these suttas and all the core teachings of the Buddha, like dependent origination, like the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, right? All these essential teachings, they are virtually identical today to what they were 2,300 years ago. And then you go another 115 years before that, you get to the time of the Buddha. So basically it means that we have the word of the Buddha today. Okay, not everybody would agree with that. People would say, what are you talking about? But I feel pretty convinced that that is the case. And I cannot really see any major holes in that argument, to be honest. So that is important, right? And you feel, and to me it is very powerful, right? When you read a sutta like this, okay, it's all about happiness. It's not just somebody's ideas. It's not just some flawed rendering of what has been passed down 2,500 years. This is the Buddha speaking to you, right? This is what it means. The Buddha is right here. When you hear these things, it is like the Buddha coming into your life and saying, this is how you should practice. Here is this amazing person who was able to discover the truth all by himself by sitting under a tree and doing meditation practice. And now he's talking to you. Isn't that kind of exciting? Isn't this kind of, it kind of brings it alive. And this is one of the reasons why how we translate this is so important. If it is translated a little bit artificially and not in a very direct way, you lose that sense of immediate contact with the teacher. Right? But if it's translated in a natural language, in the way that the Buddha would have spoken to his disciple at that time, the Buddha would have spoken in a way where people could take it on board with ease, right? Simple, ordinary language. The translation actually matters a lot. So you feel that when you're reading it, you are precisely in the presence of the Buddha himself, because that's what you are. Right? I think it's much more true than you realize. You might think I'm just making this up to make everybody kind of make yourself feel good, but that's not really the point. I mean this in a very literal sense. Why? Because remember,
the Buddha himself, he says that when he was giving his teachings, he always says that I'm teaching this for the happiness and well-being of humanity now and in the future, right? How can these teachings last for a long time into the future for the happiness and well-being of people? That's what he says. So the Buddha, from the very beginning, knew that there would be people like us, right? Reading the suttas, going on retreats. He knew this. So he presented it in a language that's very universal and very easy to access for anybody, regardless of cultural background, regardless of time frame, you know, all of these kind of things. And this is why it is so powerful. And this is why you read something which comes from India, different culture, different time, and still it resonates very easily 2,500 years later on. So the Buddha actually did think about you, right? Every one of us. And this is so powerful. So when you read that, you are actually in the presence of the Buddha in a very, very real sense. He is actually talking to you. He's not just make-believe. He did actually, when he gave the suttas, he knew what he was doing, how this would resonate into the future. So that is part and parcel of this. And this, but just to maybe elaborate a little bit more on that particular point, this particular sutta here, it starts off with virtue, right, and virtuous behavior. And there is another famous version of the sutta, which is slightly different, it's called the Upanisa Sutta. And in the Upanisa Sutta, the Buddha starts off with dependent origination. And he goes through all the links, comes down to dukkha, to suffering at the end. And then from suffering, he says that he then says, from suffering arises faith, sada, or confidence. From confidence comes the next factor, which is here, which is joy, pamuja in Pali, right? From confidence and faith comes joy. And then this whole sequence unfolds after that. So what that shows you, it shows you the direct linkage with dependent arising, moving on into this dependent liberation. So because of the way dependent arising works and ending in dukkha, that dukkha has consequences, and eventually dukkha itself leads to liberation. But the first factor there is faith, right? Sadha. Confidence, if you like. They're both acceptable translations of sadha. Faith or confidence. Faith is a bit more emotional. Confidence a bit more cognitive, if you like. More about how you think about things. But both aspects are important as far as sadha is concerned. So, so what that means is that when you experience suffering, right? And that can be, remember when we talk about experiencing suffering, it means the actual problems in life that we have, right? You know, I'm sure all of you would agree that life is not entirely unproblematic, always not kind of just one joyful event after the other, until you die joyfully in your coffin, not quite like that. It is a bit few kind of hiccups on the way. And because of that, that's one way of understanding suffering. And it's a very shallow one. But of course, it's also about the insight, right? The understanding of suffering on a more profound level. And so this is what it means by suffering giving rise to faith or confidence. When you hear the teachings of the Buddha and you realize that he is addressing exactly the problem that you are experiencing in your life, whether it is a direct experience of suffering or an insight into suffering, here is a teaching that addresses that very problem. And of course you feel, wow, this is it. I've come into the presence of this is the answer to the question of the meaning of life, right? This is it. This is exactly what I've been looking for. And this was what I had when I came across the teachings of Buddhism. I thought, wow, it took me a while to really kind of clue into that. But after a while I realized this is actually the answer to the meaning of life. This is what everybody is searching for. This is our innermost yearning of every being that feels anything is precisely what these teachings are about. They give an answer. And if you kind of, if you get that, right, that this is the answer to the meaning of life, what else are you going to do? Are you going to waste your time on things that are not the meaning of life, or are you going to kind of get on with the things that really matter? And this is the feeling you get, right? So this is why faith and confidence is so important, because you look at these teachings in that way. And that's why I was saying before about the Buddha, how to relate to the Buddha how the Buddha was teaching us, right? And how he is your teacher. And when you read the suttas, you kind of feel that you are in the presence of the Buddha. Because this is what faith is about. This is called the Buddha Nusati. You have the Dhamma Nusati, recollection of the Buddha, recollection of the Dhamma, recollection of the Sangha. When you recall this, Sangha means the Aryan, the noble Sangha. When you recall these things in the right way, and you kind of start to get the feeling for these things, that is also when faith arises. You have to think about the Buddha in the right way. When you think about the Buddha in the right way, it becomes very powerful. Think about him in the wrong way, and it doesn't make much difference. And then from that comes the Dhamma, right? The Dhamma Nusati, recollection of these teachings, which have to do with the meaning of life itself. And then you get this boost of confidence, boost of inspiration. Wow, I'm in the presence of something incredibly valuable. That's why it's called the Triple Gem, right? Not for no reason. There's a reason for that, because these are really gems. They give you everything you ever wanted. You know, an ordinary gem in life, like you get a diamond or whatever, yeah, it's not much of a big deal, right? You have a diamond, okay, maybe it looks nice, I don't know. But it's nothing. But here is something that really has a chance to transform your life and give you everything you ever wanted. That's why, of course, they are real gems, right? Triple gem, in the very high sense of the word. So it's worthwhile spending a little bit of time reflecting on the Buddha. One of the standard ways of doing the recollection of the Buddha is the Ittipiso, right? Ittipiso, Bhagava, Arahant, Samma, Sambuddho, Vijja, Charana, Sampanno, etc. This is an ordinary recollection of the Buddha. And often we do this chant in the Pali, right? We go, and probably if you come from a traditional Buddhist country, right? You go to the temple as a child, everybody kind of chants this chant, and then you go back home, you have no idea what you chanted there. Because this is what religion is like, right? If you grow up in a Christian culture, it's exactly the same thing. You go to church, somebody says some weird stuff, and you go back home again. I've got a clue what's going on. It's always like that when you grow up with a certain religion. You don't really think about it. But this is actually very powerful. And the whole purpose of this particular passage is to remind you about the Buddha, who he really was, and what he really was all about. And when you reflect about that in the right way, it becomes very powerful, right? Who is the Buddha? Bhagavan, Arahant, Arahant, Samma, Sambuddha, Vijja, Charana, Sampanno, and that with knowledge, Vijja, exactly the same thing we're talking about now, the opposite of the Avijja at the beginning of dependent arising. He is endowed with that knowledge and conduct. Conduct means that his knowledge also transfers into the way he behaves. So you can tell whether somebody has some understanding or not. Vijja Chanasampanno Sugato Loka Vidu, the knower of the world, that means that he understands happiness and suffering in the full extent, right? He has a full understanding of the world. And if the world is, as I was saying yesterday, if it really just is our internal experience, it means you can have a full understanding of the world just by going inside of yourself and knowing the full range of potential inside of yourself in terms of suffering and happiness. Anyway, I won't get too much more into that, because if I do, we will be led a little bit astray. But it's very useful to think about these things, right? Simple things. Buddha Nusati, Dhamma Nusati, Sangha Nusati. So important in Buddhism, because they can be used as a foundation stone for meditation to take off. And that's why faith is at the beginning, is at the very base there of this meditative process. So, coming back to this sutta, it's all part of this sutta really, but just being taking in a few other things at the same time. Coming back to this sutta, it's all about happiness, right? So please keep that in mind. This is such an uplifting message, right? That this is what it's all about. Not only is the end result happy, nibbana, whatever, but the whole path is a happy one, right? It's Adi Kalyana, Majja Kalyana, Pariyosana Kalyana, happy in the it's good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. It has a good effect all the way through. Right. Okay. So, that is the first aspect of this particular sutta. The second thing, which is
There's a second thing which is important about this, is that this is also a sutta which gives you like the signposts of meditation, right? The signposts of the path. Are you heading in the right direction? Is your meditation working? Is your practice working as it should do? So this is of course important, right? If you are traveling to some other city, it's nice to have, you know, going to Melbourne or whatever, Canberra, which isn't that far away. So you have this little signpost saying, okay, you're heading to Canberra, right? And then suddenly you see, okay, now the sign says something else. There's Newcastle. Okay, well, I must be going the wrong direction, right? So you get back on the main road again. So it's just like that. This is what this is all about, having signposts in your meditation practice. It does not mean that we should use our willpower to achieve these things. That's not what it means. It just means that when we are practicing it, we have some kind of guide to know that we're heading in the right direction. Right? So if you have like regret or your mind isn't very bright or whatever, then you know that at the beginning something isn't quite right. So you try to rectify that. If your meditation isn't joyful, right? Most people don't have a lot of joy in the meditation. It can be difficult to get that. People can meditate for all kinds of reasons. You know, people have some kind of depression or sadness or whatever in their life, and of course they can meditate for that reason. That's perfectly valid. But the point here is that now we're talking about the real meditation, right? The thing which really takes you, brings an end to avijja. We're talking about the kind of the real Buddhist meditation, not just the ordinary meditation to take you out of ordinary problems, but the real thing which makes you progress on the path. And that meditation should have a sense of joy in it, right? You should feel bright inside, gladness inside, peace inside. This is what this whole sequence shows you. It gives you these signposts on the road. You can tell whether you're heading in the right direction. Nothing, you know, if you don't get the gladness, it doesn't mean that you are necessarily going wrong, but it means that you should try to know that you haven't got it yet, and you should try to head in that direction so that the joy arises in your meditation. You have to look into the causes. Why isn't it arising? And I will look at that in a second to show you why that is the case. You probably have figured out yourself already, but I'll talk about it anyway. So this is the second reason why this sutta is so important, is because it is a signpost sutta. It helps you, it's like a map, right? You know where you're heading, basically. So, the third thing which is interesting about this particular sutta, I will have a look at the... let's just have a look at what it says here. Like, just take a random one of these links, right? So they're all very similar, these links. So for example, for one who is joyful, it says, link number 4 there, paragraph number 4, for one who is joyful, no volition need be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. It is natural that rapture arises in one who is joyful. Right? So what it says here, no volition need be exerted, is what it says here. So, first of all, I'm not sure if the translation is the best possible translation. The Pali for that is Na Chetanaya Karaniya, which quite literally means that this is not to be done by volition, is quite literally what it means. Which is a little bit different from need, no volition is needed, right? Because that seems to imply, okay, it may not be needed, but you can still use it. That's what it seems to say. But actually, the Pali quite literally says, this is not to be done by volition. So if you have joy, then it is not to be done by volition that you get to rapture. Right? Rather, instead of it being done by volition, it says it is natural, right? It is natural that the rapture arises in one who is joyful. So this is a natural process. It's something that happens all by itself. And volition, the will, the doing, that you are supposed to bring this into existence, that is the wrong attitude to this.
In fact, what it means the exact opposite. It means that you have to withdraw, right? You have to take away the will, you have to take away the volition, you have to take away the doing, and you just have to be passive as you can, and just enjoy the process as it goes on. That's what it means. It cannot be done by an act of will, it cannot be done by an act of volition. So the less you are involved, the less you are actually interfering with what is an entirely natural process. So this is fascinating, isn't it? So what it means is that there is nothing you have to do. All you have to do is wait, right? Of course, that is very hard, very difficult to wait, right? Most people can't wait. We are very impatient in this world. We want to get things done. Where is this happiness, right? And you crave for happiness. This is what happens to almost everybody. You have one kind of beautiful experience in meditation, right? Wow, this is so wonderful. And then you can't get it back again. Why? Because you crave for it, you desire it, you want to bring it into being. You want to make it exist, right? I'm going to make this happiness exist. No. The craving itself becomes the problem, because the craving becomes something to act upon. And because you're craving, as soon as a little bit of happiness comes, you try to grasp onto it, right? And the more you grasp onto it, the more it disappears straight away. So you just have to wait. And this is the... Once you get into that idea that all you have to do is wait and be patient, not do anything, you actually feel how nice it is not to have anything to do, right? The mind becomes, when you don't do anything, it's like the mind becomes energized. All this activity all the time, all the doing inside of us, all the craving, all the volition, all of these things, they tap our energy, and the energy kind of runs out. And then when it comes to being still, the mind becomes dull and you know, dark and tired, all these kind of things, because we've been using too much willpower. So just wait, right? Just chill, just relax. Wow, nothing to do in the whole world, right? Just waiting for happiness to come all by itself. Isn't that a great thing? It's just so beautiful when you think about it. It's so easy, right? There's nothing you have to do. It's very easy, very relaxing. And this is the great thing about this. So get yourself out of the way. And of course, it is difficult to get yourself out of the way. And the reason is because we identify with being the doer. Like I was saying before, I am the doer, right? I'm in charge. I can control things. And because you think you can control things, because that is your natural perception, you tend to get involved. And this is why it is difficult. So if you start to realize that, you know, if you start to becomes more and more clear after that you are not actually so much in charge, you're not really the doer, and the doer is just an illusion. There is doing, but you are not the doer. You have to understand the distinction here. Doing exists, but you are not really in charge of the doer. The doer itself is a conditioned process. So the more you step back and allow things to be, the more you don't involve yourself in things, the process happens all by itself. And then when the process kind of calms down, and you are not doing anything, you feel, wow, how wonderful it is not to do, right? And then you kind of are, by doing that, you are distancing yourself a little bit from your identification with the doer. You don't feel such identity anymore with the doer, because you start to feel that actually a lot of suffering all is doing, right? Why should I identify with suffering? It doesn't make any sense. So you allow the doing to be, and kind of forget about all that. So this is what this process says, that doing is the problem, and you want to withdraw from that. You want to allow the process to happen all by itself. So now perhaps you think, well, if I'm not supposed to do anything, if I'm just supposed to sit back and relax and enjoy the process, that's what I'm doing. How come it's not happening, right? This is what people often say, I'm not doing anything, I'm just sitting here. And all I feel is dull, you know, and I don't feel anything at all. Or I kind of feel my mind is going all over the place and thinking about all the things. So why is it working if it is a natural process? It's a very good question, right? I mean, and this is actually the important question that we need to answer. And the answer is very simple. Because this is a natural progression, one thing leading to another one, what we have to do is to go to the first factor, right? If everything else is a natural process coming from the beginning here, the first factor is the most important one. And if you get the first factor right, that is when the rest will unfold as a consequence. That's what this means. So this is when we say that, you know, the things are sufficient and necessary causes, one thing following after the other. Here is called the Upanisa, which is like means something like a cause, very similar kind of thing. I'm not sure if you can call it quite a sufficient cause, but a powerful cause anyway. If there is a strong sense of causality there, you need to go back to the first one. Just as a dependent arising, you start with avijja is the problem. Here, it is virtue which is the paramount thing here. If you are entirely, absolutely pure, this process just goes poof, straight away, and you go into samadhi, right? There's no, you don't even need to think about it. You sit down, bang, you go into samadhi straight away. People who are very skilled meditators, again, skilled is the wrong word, right? Because people who are very pure-hearted, they sit down, close their eyes, and they go into samadhi very, very quickly. Yeah? Especially if they are on retreat, right? Just close your eyes, and within a couple of minutes, you are in deep, deep samadhi already. Yeah? So this is the point. If the beginning part is to purify, then it will happen. Yeah? So this is the important thing in your life. If you find that your meditation is not deep enough, then you need to change your character, purify yourself. You need to change who you are as a person. And this is the most difficult thing in the spiritual life, because it takes a lot of reflection, a lot of wisdom, a lot of perseverance, right? To keep on doing these things again and again so that you actually purify yourself. It also takes radical honesty with yourself, right? You have to be very honest with yourself. Have I got some flaws? It's not always nice to be able to admit to your own flaws. But that's the only way it's going to work. If we don't want to admit to our flaws, there's no way you can overcome them. So you have to be honest about yourself. You have to persevere. And then when you do that over time, you will overcome these problems. And your character will gradually change. You become a new person. And this is what this is this is all about. So remember that. And of course, when it comes to virtue, the obvious aspects of virtue are, you know, what we normally call the bodily virtue, right? We have the virtue of speech, which often can be difficult, but obviously is very important. But in the end, it is the virtue of the mind which really matters. And I'll just talk a little bit about what is meant by the idea of the virtue of the mind. Basically means the reduction of the defilements inside. That's really what it means, right? So you want to reduce the defilements of the mind. How do we do that? And I'll maybe talk a little bit more about that in the next session afterwards. But how we do that is important to understand that there is two kind of traditional ways of overcoming the defilements of the mind. One is to use willpower, right? I'm feeling angry. No, this is bad, this is wrong. And you grit your teeth, you clench your fist, you kind of suppress the anger, or you kind of dispel it from your mind to some act of force. And this is kind of the natural human tendency to have to deal with defilements. And it never really works. If you try to suppress something, you can hold it down for a while, right? And then you come, as soon as you kind of let go, it's like a kettle that is boiling, right? You're holding the lid down, and as soon as you let go, it kind of explodes, right? And it's a little bit like that. Then the anger comes out with even more force after a while. So sometimes a little bit of suppression, or not suppression perhaps, but a little bit of kind of holding things in place can be useful if it is a very temporary and small thing. But generally speaking, there is a much more powerful technique of overcoming the defilements, and that is called using wisdom. If you use wisdom, if you think in the right way, if you look at the world in the right way, if you look at people in the right way, then what happens is that defilements tend to fall by the wayside as a consequence. And this is the way to do it. When you use wisdom, and you use your thinking mind, and you reflect about things in the right way, what happens is that not only are the defilements kept in check, but the defilements are dispelled just like that. They just disappear because you are actually changing your perception. You're changing your thinking pattern. And as soon as you change your thinking pattern, bang, they are gone. No need to suppress, no need to hold them back. They just disappear like some of these shy animals disappear as soon as you approach them in the wilderness. They're just gone straight away. This is the power of wisdom, and it's so much easier, it's so much more pleasant than having to suppress things all the time, having to hold things down. And this is what I would recommend you to do in your own practice if you can. What does it mean to use wisdom? And this is the things that we were talking about before. I mentioned this before. It is actually quite simple. It is just, again, it takes perseverance. It takes working with it again and again and again to make it work out. But it's things like, you know, you have a person. And when you see a person, you can always, you can find fault with anybody. You can find fault with the Buddha, right? People did that at the time of the Buddha. Find fault with anyone. But to remember that most people have some bad qualities, and they have some good qualities. So your job then is to remember the good qualities. Build those up in your mind. If there are some people that upset you sometimes, that particular person, remember their good qualities. Right? When you go, one of the great things about, you know, either living in a monastery or going on a meditation retreat like this, sometimes we imitate each other because we live close together. People, you know, they don't close the door quietly enough or something like that. And it irritates us, right? This is what happens. But then you remember that actually what a wonderful thing it is to be in the presence, to be together with people who are practicing the spiritual path, who want to meditate, who want to improve themselves, who want to be in health not only for themselves but also for other people. At the very, very least, we can be absolutely sure that everybody here has a positive intention, right? Isn't that worth celebrating? Isn't that a wonderful thing that people at least want to do something good? Wow, it's grand, right? So then when you feel that irritation arising, you just shift your mind and remember the big picture. What does it matter, this tiny little thing? Why be petty about things, right? This tiny little thing doesn't matter. What matters is the big picture. So you remember that, and then the petty thing is just dispelled, just like that. It's gone. And instead, you feel the sense of positivity. You feel the sense of metta, because metta really is nothing but the focusing on the good qualities of other people. So metta is focusing on the good qualities, and you feel positive and heading in the right direction. This is what I mean by wisdom. It's a very simple, right? It's not some kind of profound wisdom, but this is how you overcome these things. Or I was mentioning the other day about somebody who is very difficult. You can't see anything good in them, right? Sometimes this may happen, and then you should have compassion, because a person who has all bad qualities, well, they are suffering a lot, so regard them as a sick person instead. So these are methods recommended by the Buddha himself. And the same thing with attachments, right, and other desires as well, similar kind of wisdom that you can use to deal with these things. So this is how gradually, I can't really talk so much about this now, but usually when I teach long retreats and I talk about how to deal with the mind, I talk about this in quite a lot of detail, how to deal with defilements in a wise way. And it's actually very interesting, it's incredibly practical. And for me, this is almost like the core of what Buddhism is about, learning to change your mind, to look at the world, look at people in a different way. And it gradually, it grows, right? And you become a different person as a consequence. So this is how you do it. And as you do that, the non-regret starts to arise, right? And as I said before, the non-regret doesn't just mean, oh, I did something bad, I shouldn't have done that. It doesn't mean that. It means any kind of regret, means any kind of lowering of the energy of the mind. Any kind of, we feel a bit more dark inside, right? The joy is kind of disappears because you are kind of lowered the energy. You can feel that in ordinary life when you do something which isn't quite right. And of course, when you do what is right, it has the exact opposite effect. It increases the energy, and the mind becomes bright, and mindfulness comes as well. These are three things that tend to come together in the practice: mindfulness, energy, and joy. These are three kind of factors which tend to be present at the same time. So, this non-regret, right, that you don't have any regrets anymore. In fact, you have the opposite. You have anti-regret, right? You feel happy. I've been doing what is right. Remember the simile of the mountain of good acts that you have been doing here. And because you feel that you have been doing, you have no regret about things, and you feel good about yourself, you feel joy. You feel gladness. Yes, I've been a good person. I've done the right things, right? You feel happy about yourself. You feel joy inside. I'm sure you know what I mean when I I'm sure you know what I mean by that. And then this is where the meditation really starts to bite, right? You're sitting down, you're starting to feel joy, and now is the point where all you have to do is wait. You just sit back, right? Completely patient, not having any expectations, just enjoying what you have already. And if you just have no expectations, and you just enjoy what you have already, the meditation takes off by itself. And that joy becomes more powerful. It turns into rapture, piti in Pali, pamuja, piti. And then the piti is often can be a very strong felt kind of pleasure, felt like a physical pleasure, right? It's like kind of waves kind of going through your body almost. And it's very nice. You get to that, it feels very good, right? And body has a very positive feeling. Often the body is kind of heavy and painful. Now it feels very nice, very pleasant, very light. And then as you keep on going, remember, we're not trying to get anything here. In fact, we're doing the exact opposite. We're just allowing the process to happen. And as you go deeper, the rapture starts to die down and you start to become tranquil. You get the tranquility, the pasadi, it's called in Pali. The pasadi, which means the body starts to become incredibly settled. Right? It's like you, when you meditate like this, and the body becomes settled, it's like you feel like you don't want to move anymore, because you feel so incredibly tranquil. Restlessness is completely gone. There's no agitation whatsoever. You just feel you're sitting there. You feel like this solid like a rock, not heavy like a rock, but kind of solid. You don't want to go anywhere. It's like a rock doesn't want to go anywhere. You sit there and just feel so nice, right? So at ease, so good, just inside of yourself, watching the breath or whatever. Nothing is really happening. You don't want to go anywhere. And when you hear the bell ringing, right? Some evil monk is ringing the bell. Meditation has come to an end. Oh no, the meditation has come to an end. This is terrible. Why are they doing this to me? Finally, I'm getting somewhere. You don't actually feel so bad because you're in a positive mindset, but you know, you really would want to go on if you could, right? And this is the thing, because you're getting into that mood of meditation. It's kind of still, you know, going very well then. But then, if you have a long period of meditation, you continue, right? And from that tranquility, because it is so beautiful, because you're just sitting there, you don't want anything else in the whole world, this very subtle and beautiful happiness called sukha arises as a consequence. Very profound, deep kind of happiness in the mind. And of course, so this is just one happiness after the other, one more profound than the other. And of course, as this happens, what happens as well is that the mind becomes more and more content, right? Less and less interest in anything else. Because now you're beginning to experience happiness of an order that you have never experienced before. This is something, you've got nothing to do with sense pleasures, right? But it is actually much better. There's no craving involved, there's no future involved, there's no past. It is absolutely in the present moment. So because the happiness is right here and right now, and we feel completely content. This is how samadhi comes about. Samadhi, stillness, here called concentration. The mind just wants to stay with that, doesn't want to go anywhere else. The happiness, right? The object might be the breath, but the happiness is so powerful. You just want to hang out there, don't want to go anywhere else. And this is how samadhi arises from happiness. Because it's so easy, it is so natural to stay with an object that you're with. And then, we have from, you know, once you get into samadhi, you are entering a different world, basically. You're entering a different realm. And a realm which is, you know, for most people, completely unthinkable. But you start to realize, wow, there's so much to this mind, right? Which you never even knew about. And when you start to get into these things, it's astonishing. Anyway, so from that point, we then have the next factor here, which is now we're getting into very exalted states of mind, right? So I'm just going to go through the last factors here relatively quickly. But from that samadhi, this is actually a very important point that often people don't really recognize. From the samadhi comes seeing things according to reality. This is known as yathabhuta, yanadasana in the Pali language, seeing things according to reality. Now this is very important, right? Normally, we are taught that we have to do vipassana meditation to be able to see things according to reality. I don't really like the term vipassana meditation or samatha meditation. It's like we're dividing up the path into two aspects, samatha here, vipassana over there. Either way, I understand the Buddhist path. It's much more unified. You just practice, right? And the practice leads to two things. It leads to vipassana and it leads to samatha. It leads to calm and it leads to insight. I think this division that we often do in the Buddhist world is sometimes a bit unfortunate. I don't really see that division in the sutta. The Buddha just says you do satipatthana practice. And satipatthana is things like watching the breath, right? And from watching the breath you got samatha and you get vipassana. Things always go together. Like many famous meditation teachers have said, they're like two sides of a knife. You can't have a one-sided knife, right? It's only got one side and the other side does nothing. That would be a bit weird. It's always two-sided. They come together. And they come from the same thing. They come from the purity of the mind, from reducing the defilements. But what is interesting here is that when you want to have a very deep insight, if you want to see things according to reality, samadhi is necessary, right? So it says here. And as I was saying before, this is one of those refrains that you see again and again in the suttas. And because it is one of these teachings you see again and again in the suttas, you know that this is core, right? This is essential. This is one of the basic messages that the Buddha has for us. You have to have samadhi to be able to see things according to reality. If you want real, deep vipassana, if you really want to see things in a deep way, samadhi is the only way. And I think this is very important because sometimes it is emphasized enough, perhaps. So I think it's a very important message to take everyone. So all of this here then leads to that. And then of course, when you see things according to reality, just briefly to summarize the last points in them. The next thing is that you feel disenchantment, it says here. And the Pali word, nibbida, is the Pali word. And it is often used much more strongly than disenchantment. Often, for example, it is used of if you have a sore, an old pus is coming out of the sore of the body, right? You don't just feel disenchanted, it feels like you're repelled. You know, it's not nice to have all the pus coming out of the sore. So I would say a better translation here is actually you feel repelled by this, repulsed by it. Oh no. Why is that? Well, remember that what we are seeing here is that seeing things according to reality means seeing suffering, right? That's basically what it means. You're seeing suffering fully. How do you feel when you see suffering fully? Do you feel, whatever, I feel a bit disenchanted? No, you feel the exact opposite. You feel, no, I don't want to have anything more to do with this. You thought that something was happiness. Suddenly, your whole perception of how things are is turned upside down. You see that there is suffering there instead. And then you feel, no, I want to get away, I want out of this. And you feel a sense of being repelled by this thing we call samsara, the five khandhas, whatever else it is. No, don't want that. And then, when you feel repelled by these things, you understand that it's all suffering, then you have what is called here dispassion. And dispassion means the craving dies down, craving subsides. The opposite of passion, passion and craving, very similar, right? Dispassion, anti-craving, you let go of the craving. You can't crave for these things anymore because you understand that there's a problem with all of these things. And then, when your craving is abandoned, right? This is now we're talking about avijja being undermined. There's no avijja there anymore. You're seeing things according to reality. Avijja is disappearing. And the very last one is the knowledge and vision of liberation. And the reason why this is important is, again, if you are liberated, you know that you're liberated. There's no such thing as, what is an arahant, but you don't know it. You know, it doesn't work that way. If you're an arahant, you know that you're an arahant. There's no doubt about it. If you're liberated, you know you're liberated. So if you have any doubts that whether you're liberated or not, it probably means you're not liberated yet. Maybe I'm liberated. This doesn't work like that. Either you're liberated or you're not. So this is the last one there. And then, of course, avijja is gone, vijja arises, delusion has disappeared, and the whole dependent arising unravels, it goes into dependent cessation instead. This is the cessation mode. When avijja ceases, sankhara ceases. When sankhara ceases, consciousness ceases, right? And the whole thing unravels, and dukkha itself, suffering itself, ceases as a consequence. So it's a beautiful path. It's a wonderful thing, and So this is why it is useful to look at the psychology of this. Because when you see the psychology, you have some idea what you're supposed to experience, how this unfolds in your private being, sphere inside your mind. And you see, it's such a positive thing, right? And nobody could possibly not want this, in my opinion anyway, at least if you start to understand how these things work.